that country. You had your own efforts, and Egypt has not turned out very well. It came full circle and is back under military rule. Libya is in chaos. Syria is in chaos. Tunisia is maybe the only thing that has arguably come out of the Arab Spring that is remotely positive. Do you feel that you understand proper and potentially successful ways to extend democracy in the Middle East over your final 2 years?
Well, I think it is important to distinguish between the actions that we take to promote democracy and human rights and rule of law and good governance and the humility to understand that in the end, these things are going to happen because the people in these countries demand them.
Sometimes, the president said, people do successfully demand change, though he admits it's hard for democracy to spread in the Middle East.
You have to almost start from scratch in many of these countries. What we can do is to be opportunistic and find places where somebody's ready and willing to move forward and do everything we can to help. And Tunisia is a great example of that. Not perfect, still dangerous, still troublesome, but you've seen a civil society develop, elections take place, a constitution get drafted, Islamists being willing to be involved in the political process without trying to take it over completely, and accommodations to the fact that economic and social reforms are required for that country to succeed. You haven't seen it in Libya. It's broken off into tribal elements.
Which raises a question. Is there a responsibility by the United States to do more in Libya, having been involved in overthrowing the Gaddafi regime?
Yeah, I think the challenge that we're going to have is a recognition that we are hugely influential. We're the one indispensable nation. But when it comes to nation building, when it comes to what is going to be a generational project in a place like Libya or a place like Syria or a place like Iraq, we can help, but we can't do it for them. Now, I think the American people recognize that. There are times here in Washington where pundits don't. And they think you can just move chess pieces around the table. And whenever we have that kind of hubris, we tend to get burned. Where we're successful is where we see an opportunity, we put resources in, we support those who are trying to do the right thing for their society, and every so often, something breaks. But I think that one of the things I've learned over 6 years, and it doesn't always suit the news cycle, is having some strategic patience. You'll recall that 3 or 4 months ago, everybody in Washington was convinced that President Putin was a genius.
For taking credit.
And he had outmaneuvered all of us, and he had, bullied and, strategized his way into expanding Russian power. And I said at the time, we don't want war with Russia, but we can apply steady pressure, working with our European partners, being the backbone of an international coalition to oppose Russia's violation of another country's sovereignty, and that over time, this would be a strategic mistake by Russia. And today, I'd sense that at least outside of Russia, maybe some people are thinking what Putin did wasn't so smart.
Are you just lucky that the price of oil went down and therefore their currency collapsed, or is it something that you did?
If you'll recall, their economy was already contracting and capital was fleeing even before oil collapsed. And part of our rationale in this process was that the only thing keeping that economy afloat was the price of oil. And if, in fact, we were steady in applying sanction pressure, which we have been, that over time it would make the economy of Russia sufficiently vulnerable that if and when there were disruptions with respect to the price of oil, which inevitably there are going to be, sometime, if not this year, the next year, or the year after, that they'd have enormous difficulty managing it. I say that not to suggest that we've solved Ukraine, but I'm saying that to give an indication that when it comes to the international stage, these problems are big, they're difficult, they're messy, but wherever we have been involved over the last several years, I think the outcome has been better because of American leadership.
There is another place the U.S. is involved where it's harder to show improvement. It's the area dominated by ISIS, or ISIL as the president calls it, the group that has seized much of Iraq and Syria, setting up its own state. The U.S. has ordered limited airstrikes and sent troops to Iraq, though only as advisors.
Has your limited response to ISIS in Iraq and Syria been driven in part by a sense that this is a very dangerous threat, but not the biggest problem the United States faces in the world, and you do not want to be distracted from far bigger things going on elsewhere?
I think we can underestimate the danger of ISIL. They are a terrorist network that, unlike Al-Qaeda, has not limited itself to the periodic attack, but have aspirations to control large swaths of territory, that possess resources and effectively an army that pose great dangers to our allies and can destabilize entire regions that are very dangerous for us. So I don't want to downplay that threat. It is a real one. It's the reason why I've authorized, as part of a broader 60-nation coalition, an effort to fight back and to push them back and ultimately destroy them. But it's not the only danger we have.
The president said he wants to avoid spending, quote, another $1 trillion on Iraq. And as we neared the end of our talk in the Oval Office, he said he would rather spend money tending to the sources of American strength, schools, roads, and research.
Our best tradition is when we just lead by example, and when we are strong and secure and we're standing up for what we believe in. And we're in a great position to do that right now. And my last 2 years, my intention is going to be to make sure that that I build on the great work that we've done over the last 6 years. And I hope that I can bring the country together to do it.
Mr. President, thanks very much.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
President Obama in the Oval Office just before the holidays. We have video of this conversation at NPR.org. What you've heard is our final political interview of 2014. The conversation continues in 2015. Tomorrow, New Year's Day, we speak with Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:18. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Morning Edition is starting a new book club. The first pick is a gripping story of the rescue of 33 Chilean miners in 2010. We'll tell you more about it at about 20 minutes to 9 o'clock.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
Live in Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The search for more bodies from AirAsia Flight 8501 is suspended for the day because of heavy rains and choppy seas. The BBC's Clive Myrie is following developments off the coast of Borneo.
The government says the priority now is to recover all the bodies and the debris to try and establish what could have gone so catastrophically wrong to bring the airliner down.
The Airbus crashed on Sunday in stormy weather during a flight from Indonesia to Singapore with 162 people aboard. An Indonesian official now denies that one of the bodies found in the water was wearing a life jacket. It's already 2015 in some places. fireworks in Auckland, New Zealand, where thousands gathered to ring in the new year. In New York City, they're getting Times Square ready for tonight's festivities. Deputy Police Chief James O'Neill says security is a big job on New Year's Eve.
This event is a major commitment by the department. We will be patrolling the city by air, by sea, on the ground, and in the subway system.
And the Labor Department says first-time claims for unemployment benefits rose by 17,000 last week. They topped off at 298,000, more than economists had been expecting. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Milwaukee recorded its 87th murder of the year late last night. A man was shot to death during an argument in an apartment building. According to police, the man and a woman got into an argument with others. A man showed up with a handgun and shot the victim. So far, no arrests have been reported. Milwaukee's current murder total for the year is still 18 fewer than last year, when 105 murders took place. Coincidentally, Milwaukee's annual candlelight vigil for murder victims was last night. It was preceded by a call to action from clergy members in the central city. Pastors United is a group of 300 church and business leaders which announced their participation in a relatively new Adopt a Block program. Pastors say that churches will adopt the blocks where they're located, reaching out to neighbors, police, and others. The Adopt a Block program has been running for 4 years on Milwaukee's south side. Richard Swegler of the Faith Builders Group says it has strengthened relationships and has been bridging gaps in places where churches and the police have disconnected with their communities. The Wisconsin State Claims Board has rejected Canadian Pacific Railway's request for more than $500,000 in compensation for helping Wisconsin develop a high-speed rail line before Governor Walker killed the project. The railroad was looking for money for work performed in 2009 and 2010 to help the state prepare for a bid for federal funding to build the line between Madison and Milwaukee. State transportation officials argued they had no written contract with the railroad. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. From the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. We report next on a most violent year. That may well be one description of 2014, though we mean it here a little differently. A Most Violent Year is the name of a film by the director Sidney Lumet, whose past films set in New York include Serpico and Prince of the City. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has a review.
A Most Violent Year is a vibrant crime story. It's filled with crackling situations, taut dialogue, and a heightened sense of reality. It captures us, and it doesn't let go. Written and directed by J.C. Chandor, A Most Violent Year is set in 1981 and stars Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain as an intense Mr. and Mrs. Macbeth kind of married couple, coming to grips with a chilly month from hell. Isaac is ideal for the role of upwardly mobile businessman Abel Morales, a man possessed by the American dream. He's impeccably tailored and wears his expensive camel's hair overcoat like a talisman, indicating how far he's come and where he wants to go. He owns a Brooklyn-based heating oil company, and he tells his salesmen exactly how they should act in this tough business.
So when you look them in the eye, you have to believe that we are better. And we are. But you will never do anything as hard as staring someone straight in the eye and telling the truth.
Abel has a tight bond with his wife, Anna, played by Chastain, a wised-up and ferocious woman whose mob-connected father sold the company to Abel. Despite that, Abel is determined not to cross the line into violence when business problems arise.
Let me deal with it.
Oh, you better. You you're not gonna like what'll happen once I get involved.
One of the most satisfying things about A Most Violent Year is how many moving parts it contains, how many brush fires, like hijacked trucks and criminal investigations, Abel has to deal with, and how adroitly filmmaker Chandor orchestrates them all to achieve maximum dramatic tension. He makes Abel and Anna's strivings our own. And that's welcome news indeed.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and for the Los Angeles Times. It was a most sad year for music. We lost Pete Seeger, songwriter and singer Bobby Womack, conductor Christopher Hogwood, Joe Cocker, and many others. Here's the sound of some of their voices.
Hello again, and welcome to American Top 40. My name's Casey Kasem.
Bye-bye, love. Bye-bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry.
Sing that song.
Check it out. I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A, and the rest is F-L-Y. You see, I go by the code of the doctor of the mix. And these reasons, I'll tell you why.
Rock, 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 rock.
Jimmy Ruffin closes out our tribute to some musicians we lost this year. For more, visit nprmusic.org.
But for me, they come a tumbling down. Every day, heartaches grow a little stronger. I can't stand this pain much longer. I walk in shadows, searching for light.
This is NPR News.
Cuban-American writer Achi Ovejas says she's wary of the change in U.S.-Cuba policy, but...
For the most part, I think the Cuban-American community as a whole feels like this was inevitable, whether they agree with it or not.
A view from the Cuban exile community. Today on All Things Considered on NPR News.
Join us this afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from EdVest, Wisconsin's college savings plan. EdVest is a resource for Wisconsin grandparents to learn about gifting into a grandchild's college savings fund. Information is available at edvest.com or on Facebook and Twitter.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
Hi, I'm Joy Cardine. I'm hosting a 10-day WPR listener trip to Alaska, led by Holiday Vacations. We'll see a Prairie Home Companion live from the Chateau St. Michelle Winery in Washington before we make our way aboard the Norwegian Pearl to Alaska. We'll enjoy the sights of Juneau, Skagway, Ketchikan, the Inside Passage, and Glacier Bay. This tour departs June 12th and includes all airfare from many Wisconsin airports. Registration is open now and details are at wpr.org/travel.
Listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. American troops are back in Iraq, and for many of them, there's a sense of deja vu.
A lot of us served here before. A lot of the Iraqi generals and a lot of the Iraqi brigade commanders that were brigade commanders, battalion commanders, know us.
A homecoming of sorts for American forces in Iraq coming up right after this break. Look at our weather forecast for this New Year's Eve. Mostly sunny and very cold, with highs in the single digits and teens. Partly cloudy tonight with temperatures holding steady. New Year's Day should be partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs in the teens and 20s. The extended forecast calls for a dry Friday, then a chance of snow again this weekend, with highs mainly in the teens and 20s. Right now, Rhinelander is the coldest spot in Wisconsin at 13 degrees below zero. Right now, Superior, 3 above. Eau Claire, minus 8. And La Crosse, 2 below. Wausau, 9 below. Madison, 0. It's also 0 in Green Bay. In Milwaukee, it's 1 above.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Think of the year 2014 as the year the U.S. military stepped back into the year 2011. That was the last year U.S. troops were in Iraq. This year they have returned, 2,000 now, another 1,000 on the way, all assigned to advise Iraq's military in the fight against ISIS. They're settling back into their old bases. NPR's Alice Fordham reports.
I'm flying over Baghdad in a helicopter, accompanying Major General Dana Pittard, who's commanding American land forces in Iraq now, as he visits bases. This one's a short hop north to the muddy ground of a base called Taji to visit some of roughly 180 American soldiers who've moved in to train Iraqi troops.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
First time meeting you. Glad to meet you.
Pittard points out that many of the Americans have served here before.
If you look around the room, the combat patches here, people either served in Iraq or Afghanistan for the most part.
There are some advantages to that. This is Colonel John Reynolds.
A lot of us served here before. A lot of the Iraqi generals and a lot of the Iraqi brigade commanders that were brigade commanders, battalion commanders,
know us, the senior leaders.
But for many, it's kind of surreal to be back. America's official military presence ended here 3 years ago. Most soldiers thought they were gone for good. Meet Staff Sergeant Marlon Daly. He's deployed here a fair bit.
2003, 2004, then 2009, 2010, and then 2011, 2012.
Did you think you would ever be coming back when you flew out that day?
I did not. To be honest, I did not.
Most say they're happy to deploy. They're just sad the country unraveled. Also, they pulled out of these vast bases completely, and they're having to dig back in. The next day, we head out by plane to Al-Assad base in the province of Anbar. Here, they're much closer to the front lines with ISIS, as I mentioned to one of the Marines here.
You just missed the war a little bit ago. How many rounds did we take today?
It's four, it turns out. Rocket fire on this contingent of at least 200 coalition troops, some of them from the Marine Corps. Major Patrick Kylie remembers arriving.
It was a little spooky to walk out there and just, you know, whatever year we left this place, I mean, things are pretty much exactly as people pulled out. So you walk in, and the only difference is there's a lot of dirt in the places now.
They've been here about a month. How long will they stay?
Honestly, I don't know. It's an open-ended ride.
So they had to figure out electricity, water, heat. I get a tour of a wooden building put up by the Americans last time around, which has been refashioned into a dining hall and chapel.
This building in here has like old Marine Corps stuff painted all over the walls that's been painted over.
This Marine's name is Nolan. He doesn't want his last name used in case the Islamic State targets his family. Inside, there are surprises. So walking in, there's a Christmas tree, strings of candy canes on the walls.
You'll see like there's a rocket pole right here too.
Oh wow, so you've hung some stockings from the rocket hole, yeah?
Our messmen did.
That particular hole is old, but rockets do come in several times a week. For Corporal Zach Taylor, it's his first time in Iraq.
It's not too bad. You kind of get used to everything. Not the rockets. That's definitely one thing we'll never get used to.
Reinforcing structures has been a big part of his first month.
Usually dudes, they get off post, they do 6 hours of filling sandbags, and that's, you're probably doing around 12 hours a day.
You're spending 12 hours a day filling sandbags?
Easily.
In fact, when they do get hit with rockets or shells, they can call in airstrikes. They can watch a live video feed as aircraft bomb the extremists' positions. But despite the infrastructure and the warplanes, the Americans I met insisted on one thing. They're not here to fight the war. They said they're not going into this country to clear it again, and it's the Iraqis who'll have to do it for themselves. Alice Fordham, NPR News.
Here is a plausible New Year's resolution. Read more. Maybe like many resolutions, that promise would come to nothing. But if you like to read, there is a way to make space for it. You join the Morning Edition Book Club, which we call Morning Reads. Our first book was selected by author Ann Patchett.
Now, I'm somebody who cries maybe once every 2 years. I'm just not a crier. But I cried when I read this book.
The book she picked is Deep Down Dark, the untold stories of 33 men buried in a Chilean mine and the miracle that set them free. The author is Hector Tobar. He tells the true story of a 2010 disaster and how the world expected the worst when this news broke.
A rescue effort underway at a gold and copper mine in Chile since Thursday, now suspended after a second cave-in.
But the story changed dramatically. Hope surfaced more than 2 weeks after the cave-in in the form of a note attached to a drill bit.
The note said, "All 33 of us are fine in the shelter." Rescuers say
tonight is the night at the San Jose mine. Rescue efforts are set to begin for 33 men who've been trapped.
Florencio Avalos, the first miner out, emerged near midnight on Tuesday in a narrow metal cage that had been named the Phoenix.
For Ann Patchett, the miner's story is universal.
What is your life worth when you are right up against death for a prolonged period of time? Then who do you become? What do you care about? What are your values?
We want to hear questions like those and more from you. Join our book club by reading Deep Down Dark and then tweet us or post on Morning Edition's Facebook page. We're going to put some of your questions to Hector Tobar when he joins us on the program for our book club discussion on January 20. Now, this New Year's Eve is a day of celebration for some, and for others, a day of work.
There's about 75 pyrotechnicians preparing for that proverbial push of the button at midnight.
That is Phil Grucci, president of Fireworks by Grucci, and he's talking about one of the biggest New Year's Eve fireworks displays in the country on the Las Vegas Strip. Grucci's family company has been producing displays for six generations. Ancient as fireworks are, the technology has evolved. The company uses microchips to time the explosions.
The days of the cartoons when you used to watch Bugs Bunny and you see a little rocket go up in the air and explode out comes a flag. Now we're able to produce things like that.
And success is measured by the crowd's reaction.
You can hear the crowd roar when something really tickles their fancy.
And if it does not, Grucci makes note of it for another year. Admit it, you're moving. This is NPR News.
It's 8:41. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, the supply and demand behind Uber's surge pricing on New Year's Eve, one of the ride service's busiest nights of the year. Our weather forecast today should be mostly sunny and very cold, with afternoon highs in the single digits and teens.
Cuban-American writer Achi Ovejas says she's wary of the change in U.S.-Cuba policy, but...
For the most part, I think the Cuban-American community as a whole feels like this was inevitable, whether they agree with it or not.
A view from the Cuban exile community, today on All Things Considered on NPR News.
Listen this afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. It's dark and the weather is rough off Borneo, where crews have been working to recover bodies from AirAsia Flight 8501. Work is suspended until tomorrow amid the heavy rains and choppy seas. Indonesian officials say they expect some bodies of those who were aboard the airliner to wash up on beaches. Malaysia's transport minister says he's hopeful the investigation into this crash will help aviation experts.
Continue to increase and uplift the aviation standards and safety standards.
The plane's black boxes have not yet been found. That flight disappeared from radar on Sunday with 162 people aboard. Volkswagen is recalling about 38,000 cars because of engine fires caused by a fuel leak. The recall includes VW Beetles, Jettas, and Passats from 2014 and 2015. New Year's Eve in Las Vegas will likely include colder than normal temperatures and maybe some snow. Meteorologist Clay Morgan is with the National Weather Service.
This one's looking less impressive than it did a few days ago. It looks like most likely for the valley floor here, less than an inch, maybe just some flurries.
In New York City, forecasters say temperatures in the 20s are likely at Times Square. On Wall Street, stocks are higher in early trading. At last check, the Dow was up 33 points, the Nasdaq up 11. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. The Wisconsin legislature's most powerful committee will have two new Democratic state representatives. Chris Taylor of Madison and Gordon Hintz of Oshkosh were appointed yesterday to the Joint Finance Committee, which will have the job of rewriting Governor Walker's next state budget proposal. Corey Mason of Racine was removed from Joint Finance and put on five other committees. A total of 12 Republicans and four Democrats will serve on the Finance Committee. They'll hold public hearings around the state after Walker submits his budget package early in the new year. The finance members will also meet with agency leaders before writing a final package to submit to lawmakers. The Wisconsin pass defense will have quite a challenge containing Auburn in tomorrow's Outback Bowl despite the loss of the Tigers' top receiver. Dakeel Williams will sit out the game for violating team rules. Auburn still has a bevy of receivers who will try to take advantage of a Wisconsin secondary that got burned badly in the Big Ten championship game. Auburn has 39 passing plays of 20 or more yards this season, and six of those plays stretched out for at least 40 yards. New York City has its famous ball drop in Times Square on New Year's Eve, but Plymouth, Wisconsin celebrates in its own way with its annual giant cheese drop. Hundreds of spectators are expected to watch as an 80-pound wedge of cheese descends from a 100-foot fire truck ladder at the stroke of midnight. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights. Information available at ajws.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the Joyce Foundation, working to encourage businesses and consumers to save money and electricity through energy efficiency, joycefdn.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. It's hard to know what events, what little moments, will change your life. Marie Kohler discovered her passion for the theater as a girl, the urging of her mother.
One night after dinner in 1961, my mother said to me, "Come with me tonight. Watch a rehearsal while I'm at my theater meeting." A shy 10-year-old, I wanted to stay home and read The Secret Garden again, my wont during her meeting nights, but there was no resisting. I mumbled okay and dragged my feet. My mother adored the theater. An amateur actress in her youth, by 50, she'd thrown herself headlong into an astonishing list of local causes, Sheboygan's Community Players high among them. Leading me into the darkened space, she planted me at the back of the enormous auditorium. Stunned at the hall's vastness and my solitariness, I begged her to please let me wait in the car. I did not belong there. She whispered back that that was silly. I did belong there, and I'd be fine, and left for her board meeting. I gripped the metal handrail along my seat and hung on for dear life, panicked and alone, waiting for it to be over. Soon my eyes adjusted to the dark. Far away, I spied two lonely figures standing on the stage. No costumes, no set. Suspended in the dark void, they looked like tiny dolls, vulnerable before the sea of empty seats. I sensed some electricity in the air. Something seemed to be at stake. I watched hard. I recognized the actor, a nice man who worked in the same office as my father. He began speaking in a kind of herky-jerky way, something about a dagger. Staring intently in front of him, he uttered, "Is this a dagger which I see before me?" with an awful fear. I couldn't see what he was referring to, but I certainly believed he saw it. Something magical was happening. I was alert. The woman stepped forward alone. I recognized her as well. She looked down, becoming very still. When she looked up, she was transformed. No longer the pharmacist's wife and the mother of two cute little girls, she was a towering figure of palpable power. Her words, crazy and disturbing. What did they mean? How did these adults I'd known for years change themselves into such astounding characters? What was the power in that room? I was in awe. Ever since that first rehearsal, Shakespeare's Macbeth, of course, I've been in love with the strange magic of making theater. Even now, after 3 decades working as actor, producer, playwright, and director, the phenomenon of rehearsing strikes me as one of the most heroic human endeavors. I'm still in awe. During a rehearsal, I feel I'm in a sacred space charged with intense commitment, courage, and respect. I hugely honor the shared mission of a group of people in one room, together but alone, working on a story larger than their own, striving to make meaning in the dark. If I could, I'd tell her she was right. I did belong there. She probably wouldn't be surprised.
Marie Kohler is an award-winning playwright, actor, and writer who lives in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org, and you can find Wisconsin Life on Facebook. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Classical music comes your way at 9 o'clock. Today's highlights include the Haydn Symphony. Join Ruth Ann Bestman for Morning Classics right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
Future without him. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support local theater productions. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
We'll wrap up 2014 under mostly sunny skies and with very cold temperatures. Highs this afternoon won't get any warmer than the single digits and teens. Temperatures should hold steady with a few more clouds tonight. Tomorrow, variable clouds, a chance of snow with highs in the teens and 20s. We expect a dry day tomorrow with a chance of snow this weekend, and afternoon highs should remain steady in the teens and 20s.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Minnesota Marine Art Museum, College of St. Scholastica, and Paisan's Portabella. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Learn diesel equipment technology. Earn up to $70,000 annually. Inspect and repair any vehicle with a diesel engine, including buses, trucks, and boats. High-tech, high-paying transportation careers. Get info at gtc.edu.
The perils of predicting interest rates on New Year's Eve.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. A year ago, the benchmark for American interest rates, the 10-year Treasury yield, was at 3% even. Now it's down at 2.17%. Who would have thought that on New Year's Eve 2013? The S&P 500 was in the 1840s back then. Now it's at about 2080, a rise of 240 points, give or take, more than 14% for the year. Let's say Happy New Year to Mark Vintner, Managing Director and Senior Economist at Wells Fargo Securities.
Happy New Year.
So here we sit, Mark, on the cusp of a new year, and you'd think there's nowhere to go but up for interest rates with the U.S. economy improving here. Yet a year ago, right, Mark, we would have said the same thing, and interest rates did not do that.
We're going into the new year much the same way we did into 2014. Expectations are pretty squarely on a rise in interest rates because the economy is clearly improving. But the U.S. is an outlier. The rest of the world seems to be pretty much dead in the water. So a greater chance that rates are going to increase than come down further.
And you and I were just talking before we went on, and of course you brought up the price of oil. I mean, it's down another 2% using the Texas benchmark even this morning, around $53 a barrel.
Right now, the expectations are that prices will find a bottom in the spring and move back up over the summer, but I'm not so sure of that. The drop in prices is largely due to the surge in U.S. production and weakness in overseas demand. And I don't see either factor reversing in 2015.
Well, consumers will help. We'll have more money in our pockets because of the low gas prices.
It won't help immediately, even though prices have come down very quickly. And I filled up the other day for $2.09 and kicked myself because then further down the road it was $1.99. But it slowly accrues over time. And so the benefits from lower gasoline prices will probably kick in late spring and throughout the summer when folks tend to drive more.
Mark Vintner at Wells Fargo Securities, who apparently shops for gas in North Carolina, right, Mark?
Well, that was in Virginia. Here in North Carolina, it's a little pricier. I was driving back home over the holidays, but it's certainly good to see. Prices are coming down pretty much across the country.
Mark, thank you.
You bet.
And if this longer-term view is not for you, let's get back to some narrower short-term thinking. The Dow in the first 23 minutes of trading is up 33 points, 0.2%. NASDAQ up 0.25%. The S&P 500 is up just about 0.1%. Since we're not supposed to drive and the culture urges people to drink, those car services you summon with a smartphone app are expected to have their big night tonight. Lyft and Uber and others use algorithms that raise prices when demand goes up. Yet when that happens, annoyed passengers complain to the world using Twitter, which can be bad for business in the longer run. Marketplace's Noel King reports on this tension.
Uber's surge pricing policy is economics 101. If demand is low, then prices are stable. When demand is high, like on New Year's Eve, prices go up, sometimes way up. Matthew Feeney is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute. He says nobody's being tricked here.
Uber allows you to estimate the fare before a ride begins. Uber tells customers when the surge is in effect. So there really isn't an excuse for not knowing that the price is going to increase.
But even if there's no trickery and the economics make sense, surge pricing is still confusing to many people, says Paul Argenti. He's a professor of corporate communications at Dartmouth's Tuck School.
What does that mean to your normal American? You say there may be surge pricing. I mean, it's not a term that you hear when you go to Walmart. Oh, we're going to have a surge pricing today.
The debate over surge pricing probably won't be solved by tonight. But in the meantime, new kid on the block, Flywheel, is offering some New Year's night rides for a flat fee of only $10. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Wix.com, giving millions of business owners the ability to create their own professional website. You can create a website today online at Wix.com. By Angie's List, providing access to consumer reviews on plumbing, landscaping, HVAC, house cleaning, and more. Now offering an updated iPhone app. More at Angie'sList.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate high school prepared to succeed in college and careers.
And now, what should we call it? Corporate Anthropology, a chronicle of a rite of passage. 4 years in the works, Southwest Airlines has now fully engulfed what was once AirTran Airways, formerly ValueJet. Jim Burris, a reporter with WABE in Atlanta, was there for AirTran's very last flight.
Cheers erupted as AirTran's Boeing 717 took off Sunday night from Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, bound for Tampa. Flight 1 was long sold out. More than 800 hopeful travelers added their names to the standby list. Southwest Bob Jordan has been running AirTran's operations for the past few years. Over a scratchy PA system, he thanked AirTran's employees.
This is awesome. It's a fantastic way to commemorate this last flight. And a fantastic way to commemorate moving forward together as one awesome company.
The journey traced ValueJet's 1993 inaugural flight. After a deadly crash in the Florida Everglades in 1998, ValueJet struggled to survive. It eventually reemerged as AirTran. Trish Kreider worked as a flight attendant under both names. She says AirTran's final moment is a proud one.
The fact that we fought from ValueJet all the way through to where we are, to be a company that Southwest wanted to own, is just the most amazing, amazing experience.
By airline standards, Southwest's merger with AirTran was smooth. For one thing, there were no layoffs. AirTran flight attendant Tana Thomas says the airline's family-like corporate cultures were a lot alike, and that helped.
I see their scrappiness as being almost one and the same. It's like they're on full throttle.
Southwest now has access to key markets like Washington National and Atlanta. The merger also opened up international routes for the first time. And although it's been a long merger, it's proving to be a profitable one. Air Transport World just named Southwest its airline of the year, and its stock was the year's best performer on the S&P 500. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
And patent number 8922530, granted yesterday, goes to Apple of Cupertino for a new pen-like thing. You draw or write on any surface to trace on a separate screen. Artists now use a stylus on a special pad to draw on screen, and there's also a special pen with special paper that does this. Apple's innovation is an input device that works on anything. You could trace a person's nose, you know, if you and the nose were so inclined. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's more news for you throughout the day with headlines from NPR and WPR at noon, All Things Considered from 3 until 6:30, and stories to listen to, read, and comment on anytime at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company. ATC provides a pathway for power into communities throughout Wisconsin. ATC owns and operates the high-voltage electric transmission system that helps keep the lights on, businesses running, and communities strong.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
You're listening to WGTD HD,